Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. Colleagues, today is May 11th, 2015. We're convened for the purposes of a public hearing on the Department of Corrections budget. This will be kind of our phase two second dive into the data. So we will have the department come forward in just a moment, but I also wanted to extend a courtesy to AFSCME's Executive Director, Ken Allen, to present once DOC gets done, unless you had to roll early. But if we could just kind of try to time the delivery so that we would give Mr. Allen some time to make some comments at the end. All right, Director.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colette Peters, Director of the Department of Corrections, and it really is a pleasure to be here for phase two of our budget presentation. We just spent all of last week celebrating National Corrections Employees Week, and so we've been thanking those corrections professionals in our prison and in the field. We could not thank them enough, but we come here before you refreshed and rejuvenated following that week. So I'd like to start by following up on an outstanding item from phase one. The committee asked for information on two studies that have been completed regarding our Parenting Inside Out program. The first was a five-year study from 2003 to 2008, funded by the National Institute of Mental Health and conducted by the Oregon Social Learning Center. Researchers interviewed and followed Oregon inmates who were going to actually be actively parenting upon release. The study found that it was effective. Women were 48% and men were 26% less likely to be arrested 1 year after their release from prison. The results of the study have been presented at several national and international research conferences. They have been accepted for publication in multiple peer-reviewed journals and have been included in two books. The study and its results were reviewed by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and Parenting Inside Out was added to the National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs. In addition to be included in that registry, PIO appears on the model programs list put out by the Federal Bureau of Prisons and has been evaluated and received a rating of 87 out of 100 points by the Research and Fidelity Group of the California Department of Corrections, and we have included a copy of those findings in your appendix for your further review. The second was a study that was reported to have been completed by the DOC research unit. I followed up with our research team and found that while some analysis was completed and I think shared with some of the individual legislators on this committee, a formal research paper was not validated or written. And so we didn't have a report to actually give to you. According to Dr. Bilotti, his limited analysis was not nearly as good as the OSLC study because our analysis did not account for actually who was going to be parenting on the outside, and it included all that received the Parenting Inside Out program. So the OSLC was a randomized control design and had much better depth and breadth. So we've relied on that moving forward. I also wanted to talk about one of our KPMs, one of our key performance measures. We didn't get to dive into this in much detail in phase one, so I wanted to go a little bit deeper because we're actually going to request the committee if we can change this particular KPM. This key performance measure has actually been in place for many years, and we have been using Community Corrections as our customer and sending out surveys to them in order to complete this KPM. As we really reflected on this, Community Corrections is really our partner, not our customer. And following our organizational review and all the work that we've done around CORE, our Correctional Outcomes Through Research and Engagement, we want you to consider a change to this measure. The customer that we would now like to focus on is visitors of the adults in our custody. I've talked to many of you individually about this, and I've talked about the Minnesota Department of Corrections study before this committee in the past. But just quickly, when I came on as director just over 3 years ago. This study had just been released, and it had determined that visiting was a significant indicator of success upon release. Well, 3 years ago, only 59% of the adults in our custody received visits. And so we pushed forward a major initiative. We introduced video visitation in all of our prisons. The adults in our custody now have the ability to have limited electronic messaging with their friends and family. We have a new phone system that has voicemail capability, and we have increased visiting hours at all of our prisons and expanded those special family visits that we traditionally did very well at our women's prison, and we've now rolled them out to all of our male prisons. So through all of these efforts, we've actually been able to turn this statistic on its head, and it said that 59% of those in our custody were not receiving visits. And now we've turned that on its head, and now more than 70% of the adults in our custody have received visits. And really, that number could even be higher, because we're not tracking those individuals who received visits during those enhanced family visits. So we're really proud of that work. So our methodology would actually include a survey to those individuals that have visited our prisons, and focus groups that would identify the strengths and weaknesses of our current visitation program from a visitor perspective. So the DEOC researchers will actually visit all of our 14 institutions and actually engage and survey those visitors. And then we will be able to focus on establishing a baseline for where we are at now in terms of our customer service delivery, and continue to review that data and change how we manage our operations based on that input. So if the committee approves changing the customer to visits, our hope is that we improve visiting even further in an effort to increase that family engagement and reduce recidivism. And now I will turn our attention to budget. While I have spoken with each of you either in person or over the phone regarding our 13-15 budget, I wanted to bring the committee up to speed as a full body. On February 18th, we requested $32.8 million in general fund to assist in offsetting our anticipated budget deficit for this biennium, for 13-15. Thankfully, you approved $29 million of that request, with the understanding that the agency would return for the remaining $3.8 million if the updated budget numbers required that. Also with the understanding that the Department of Corrections would continue to do everything they could to drive that budget deficit number down. So now, based on our current expenditure forecast, we have an unanticipated increase of $4.3 million in medical supplies and an overall projected deficit of $7.2 million. Now, as I've shared with each of you individually, this is really being driven by our Hep C cost increase. So the agency has actually continued in other parts of the agency to drive that deficit down, but the new Hep C medication is really at the root of this increase. So please be assured that we will continue communications with this committee as we get to the closing of our biennium. So as requested, I'll now shift our focus to the governor's balanced budget for 15-17. This chart here shows an overview of the governor's budget, which includes $1.6 billion in total funds for the agency. And that would leave us with approximately 4,450 FTE. This chart also shows how our total budget is broken down by division, debt service, capital improvement, and capital construction. So you can see the bulk of our budget goes to three very distinct program areas: our operations division, which is most of our personnel at 45%, community corrections at 16%, and health services very closely behind community corrections at 15%. You'll see that the bulk of our staff work in the operations division, which includes our health services team, representing about 85% of our staff. You'll also notice that 95, almost 96% of our budget is funded by the general fund. Our current service level equals $1.6 billion, and that is derived from almost $102 million increase from the DOC's 15-17 base budget. Just to highlight the increases for you, they're created through essential packages, adjusting for standard and inflationary, extraordinary inflation at almost $34 million, an adjustment for future vacancies at about $35 million, prison and community corrections caseload adjustment at about $27 million, phase in and out of one-time budget reductions at the cost of about $7 million, and increases in state government service charges is the remaining example. Now, the governor's balanced budget makes $38 million in investments based on our 15-17 policy option packages. And prior to the meeting getting started, I know that Senator Bates was interested in seeing all of our policy option packages as presented in the agency request budget. And if it pleases the committee, we'd be happy to share that list with all of you. Okay, thank you. These investments will be financed, if approved, through $27.6 million in bond funds, $10 million in general fund, and $122,000 in federal funds. I would like to detail these policy option packages. Now, we did bring a picture of what a portion of our file system looks like today that you can see up here on this PowerPoint presentation, but I'd also like to go further and actually paint this picture for you. If you walked into the medical records room of our larger facilities, you would literally see hundreds of yellow placeholder cards in these files that are scattered throughout them, denoting that the file has been temporarily transferred to our mental health staff in another part of the institution. The institutions have large carts that push these files through these prisons for the sole purpose of manually transferring these files from mental health to medical health staff. If medical staff needs the file and it's over at mental health, then resources are literally used to run these files back and forth. Another example, every time an inmate transfers between institutions, we need to track down files and make sure they are transferred as well. So imagine this scenario, an inmate housed at our Powder River facility in Baker City is assigned to a fire crew. He ends up working on a fire down in Coos Bay, twists his ankle and breaks it. He's then transferred via medevac to a hospital in Medford. Now, Medford needs medical information on the parent. They ask the staff that are there. It's the Forest Service, and they don't have that information. They ask security, and they don't have that information. Another one of our institutions gets called because it's the closest one to Medford. SCCI determines that the inmate is from Powder River, so they contact Powder River. Well, that inmate was a recent transfer to Powder River, and his medical file is actually still at our Snake River Correctional Institution. Now, I know that's a bit of a dramatic example, but my staff are dealing with examples like that every single day. And now, especially with the Affordable Care Act, we are starting to see more inmates that come to us actually having had some community care. That's a good thing. But we want to access those records as well. Currently, those providers fax us that information. When the inmate releases sometimes 20 years later, or even a decade later, that individual could potentially have a file folder that is 2 feet high and weighs 20 pounds.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Williamson.
For the committee, I visited several facilities, and I actually saw the file room at Snake River, and it was shocking, to say the least. And when I met with the mental health staff, actually, and the medical staff said the same thing. They often hide files from each other. I don't know that they would say this publicly, but because they can't, it takes so long to get them back. And if they know they're seeing someone, then they won't put it back in the file room because they know next time they go to get it, it might not be there. And so, and it was funny because both medical and mental health staff said the same thing about the other office. So it was a real issue, especially for mental health and being able to get access to these files.
Senator Bates.
Just so we keep it in perspective, if you go to any major hospital, my office, or any other office, this is what it looks like.
Right.
And we are moving away from it. We are some areas moving faster than others, and some have overreached to move too fast. And you end up with this plus an electronic medical record. We have a big problem with medical records talking to each other. With the scenario you just described is really not uncommon. It really isn't. We are just starting to develop these things. I would like to help you with this by working with OHA, which is getting together a statewide way of transferring information amongst hospitals, doctors, and your system would be involved in that too. You're going to have to make some tough decisions about which system to choose, and I would be glad to help you with that because I know what's wrong, but I'm not sure I know what's right. But I can tell you what's wrong, okay? You probably can team up with the CCO that are doing this and do it at a reasonable cost. If you can do this for, what was it, $3 million? That's a pretty amazing price. That's pretty low, and I'm hoping that that's real. But I'd be glad to work with you on this. I really would. Okay.
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, thank you so much, and thank you for the example. Makes me a little nervous, but thank you for the example.
I thought long and hard about whether or not I should say it on the record, but
I think one of the things that's unique to healthcare in prison is that we really are able to operate like a CCO because the medical and mental health staff, the dental staff, all could and should be talking to each other.
Right.
And so while your office is able to maintain those files and keep them there, we have an obligation to provide that umbrella care for these individuals, and so our staff being able to talk to each other and share those medical files is so important. It really does create a different dynamic since we're one entity providing both the mental health and medical care. So any help in that regard would be great. I'll give you an update right now on where we are in the process as we at least prep for the hopeful financing of this project. We've completed working with a consultant. Senator Bates, I know that we've talked to you about this in detail offline, but we've worked with a consultant that specializes in correctional electronic health record systems because it is unique and it is different. And other systems have figured out how to do it well in prison, and we want to learn from what they've learned, including their mistakes. So please know that we're taking that very seriously. So we're submitting this significant package of pre-planning work for acceptance as completion of the first stage gate in the DAS ITS implementation schedule. We know, and you all nodded your heads, that we will reap long-term benefits for this upfront investment.
Excuse me, Director. Senator Winters.
I just want to reinforce some of the comments that Senator Bates made. A couple of things. I mean, I can appreciate what other states are doing. However, not all states have a CCO reform model that we have in Oregon. And given the work that we're doing on reentry and connecting the individual from DOC back to the community, I think it's imperative that we actually make certain these systems are talking to each other. And when I saw those files, it was reminiscent. In fact, my files were a lot higher and more than that when I was up at the University of Oregon Med School. So understand the problem. It's just making certain that we get all the connectors tied together so that, you know, truly we're able to talk to each other, and both inside DOC as well as coming out of DOC.
And I would like to piggyback on Senator Winter's words. What other prison systems are doing is interesting, but hopefully they won't be going from Oregon Department of Corrections to the Washington Department of Corrections or to the federal system. That's not where the rub will be. And I think if you look at I know just from my experience running the business side of my wife's primary care practice, there are two or three electronic medical records that 90% of people are using: Epic, Practice Fusion. And if you could come up with a system that could talk to those, I think it would just put the inmates' health care a year ahead of time when they're scratching their heads trying to remember what medication they took in their third year of an eight-year incarceration. And that would just be my two bit of advice.
Co-chair, specifically Senator Shields, that is no doubt at the top of our list of things that we would absolutely want out of a system, is one that could talk that full circle. By learning from other states, it wasn't so that we could necessarily connect with them, because you're right, my hope is that they don't graduate from the Oregon Department of Corrections and end up at the Washington Department of Corrections someday, but it is to learn about that system implementation in prison. And so we commit to you that the system that we provide, while we understand there isn't one out there that's perfect, we commit to you that it will be one that speaks to the other systems in Oregon, so that we really can have that continuity of care from the time they leave the community, come to our care and custody, and go back into the community again.
And I think certainly I would like to be kind of updated as you're going forward, as you let us know what you're going to be purchasing. I'd appreciate at least a 20-minute phone appointment as you're getting close to a decision before you sign contracts, and I think Senator Bates would like to do the same.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add on to that? One of the successes that we actually realized, in fact more than one, with eCourt was that the business plan and all that was done before we actually entered into the contract, that the plan was well thought out, well put together, and then it became the deliverables. And whoever we have, they don't get paid until it's delivered. I think that's important and critical. Because it's one thing from off the shelf that actually is packaged for someone else. It's another where you're doing the plan that specifies what we would like to see as outcomes. And I think particularly since, we passed the legislation that allows us to begin that whole transition back to the community, I think becomes very, very critical and important. And the work that we're doing over in DHS to make certain that the CCOs are finding a home for the individuals, I think it all comes together. I think we realize that we can't separate anymore. And this work of silos, whether it's DOC from DHS and mental health and some of our other treatment modalities. So I just really encourage that those plans, when you talk to your consultant, that, that kind of planning takes place.
And another thing, there was a group that I was involved in Portland called the Physician Management Practice Group or something. So it's people behind the scenes who actually do the mechanics of running a practice. It's not the providers who, frankly, have no idea how a lot of this stuff works. No offense, Dr. Bates. But
true.
But the business managers like Lori, who really know the mechanics of how the CPT codes work and all that. But that way, and I think what you're hearing is that maybe a work group that could provide feedback as you go along. We could bring people together, and that way, if the whole thing implodes, we'll all be to blame.
Co-chair, specifically Senator Shields, thank you. We will accept your backup. Now, I'd like to talk about the possibility for another successful IT project. The next is our corrections information system. When I arrived to the Department of Corrections 11 years ago, bells and sirens were ringing, and I was told that our CIS system 11 years ago was being held together with duct tape and baling wire. And here we are, 11 years later. This critical system, again, is about as dramatic as my last presentation on those electronic or the paper files. The system still uses a programming language that was designed before I was born in the early 1960s. This is a dying language. The programming is not sustainable and does not allow us to keep pace with technology and practice changes. Dr. Kimberly Bernard from Multnomah County, I don't know if you remembered her presentation during public testimony during phase one, but I would like to describe the system to you using her words, because she does just a fantastic job, I think, of highlighting the system. There is no mouse required, because mouse navigation does not exist in CIS. There's no web browser for anyone using the CIS computer system. There's actually no place inside the system where we can enter an email for an offender. So if someone from Community Corrections actually wants to communicate via email with someone on their supervision, they actually need to keep that email in a different spot. The same holds true for cell phones. There's no data field for a mobile phone in CIS. This is a field community corrections could use to communicate with an offender, as well to use as data mining for phone numbers listed on websites used for prostitution and other human trafficking activities to increase that level of community supervision. There's also no data field to enter progress reports from outside providers for offenders receiving alcohol and drug treatment, counseling, or other court-ordered services. Under the current system, again, a very antiquated process, an outside provider types progress notes for an offender, either faxes or emails the information into us, and then the officer actually has to retype the progress notes for each offender into CIS. The labor savings alone with an upgrade to the system would be extremely significant. So, in short, the programming that you experience daily with private companies, or quite frankly, even in other areas of state government, is missing in CIS. The ability to integrate and enhance our data that we all take for granted in our daily lives is really missing at the Department of Corrections. So this policy option package will enable DOC to work very closely with the Office of Chief Information Officer and design an RFP and implementation plan that provides a replacement system that effectively meets the needs of DOC and its stakeholders. And again, like we had spoke to in the last policy option package, this will be a thorough vetting process to ensure that we would actually have a successful replacement or upgrade of CIS. Next on our list of things to talk about is capital investments, of which there are four packages, and these packages total $33.2 million. They include deferred maintenance, telephone system upgrades, inmate information services, and a conversation around the cost of financing. And I'll talk about these in more detail. The Department of Corrections actually owns 325 buildings scattered across the state of Oregon, totaling about 5,500,000 square feet, with a replacement value of about $1.3 billion. Currently, we have an unfunded deferred maintenance liability of about $68 million on these buildings. The capital investment package that we're proposing in the amount of $14.2 million in bond funding will only address 25 of the highest priority deferred maintenance items issued throughout the Department of Corrections. All of these projects that we're proposing are priority number one status, and that is a status that includes life, health, and safety projects that are critical to our operations. So, to state the obvious, without proper facilities funding, staff are required to come up with workaround solutions to keep our facilities operational, which you all know becomes both expensive and risky. And here you'll actually be able to see in a photograph two of our institutions that have significant roof issues. The top left picture is our Columbia River Correctional Institution located in Portland. And at the bottom right is a picture of our activities building at Saniam Correctional Institution here in Salem. Both of these roofs were redone in the 1990s using 20-year roofing materials. We're now at 25 years, and the roofing material has exceeded its life and requires replacement. The next picture that you see is actually the river near South Fork Forest Camp. As you can see, it's actually causing erosion of the bank and the roadway, which has now exposed piping and electrical conduit associated with the sanitary sewer system. So if this further erodes, the stabilization is needed to actually support continued operation of our sanitary sewer system, which you can imagine is something we do not want to have fail.
Will that seep down into Salem?
Co-Chair Senator Winters, I don't know the answer to that, but I will ask. Will your willingness to support depend on the answer to that question?
Well, I mean, anytime you, Mr. Chair, yes. Anytime you talk about something upstream, it tends to go downstream.
That's correct, co-chairs and Senator Winter. Thank you for stating the obvious. So while this is a dramatic example of something that could actually go wrong, these are just a couple of examples. We also have six institutions that are requiring upgrades to their HVAC system, two institutions that are requiring substantial upgrades to their electrical, two other institutions that have sewer or water system upgrades that need attention, and then seven institutions that actually need some pretty substantial repairs and upgrades to the actual security system at those institutions.
Excuse me, Senator Bates.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. In our initial discussion way back when, there was discussion about opening up Deer Creek and closing four other institutions down because it's a new facility and but unoccupied right now. And mothballing the other four until they actually might be needed in the future. I'm not sure we had a further discussion about that. If it did, I missed it. And I'd like to see some kind of an idea of what that would do as far as cost is concerned, cost savings, and what it might do to cut down overtime and take stress off the workers themselves, which is a major concern from what I've read, anyway. I know it would be disruptive for people working at the other facilities. They might have to move or make other transfers, but could you give us something on that at a later time?
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, we certainly can and will provide that information to you. Now that I think that conversation was one we were able to have at the onset of the public safety reform conversations, 3194 as introduced would have given us enough relief over the 10-year period to actually have that conversation. While we weren't able to pass the bill, since we weren't able to pass the bill as introduced, we're actually now going to need the Deer Ridge Correctional Institution in the 10-year period. So now I don't believe it makes sense to actually shut down those facilities and open Deer Ridge now, when in fact we'd have to reopen those facilities in a very short period of time.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Department of Administrative Services is seeking a new telephony solution for all state agencies. I'm sure you've heard about this project before. To meet the required Voice over Internet Protocol, or VoIP, standard of the new vendor, the Department of Corrections will be required to upgrade nearly its entire telephone structure. The DOC system will require a one-time cost of $12.2 million in bond funding to support changing our existing analog system to digital. An additional $1.5 million of an ongoing general fund allocation will also be required to meet the additional telecommunication cost of supporting the system. So without investment to enable DOC to effectively convert to VoIP, we will need to seek out our own analog provider, which are becoming obsolete, so it really isn't a great solution. The department currently operates an inmate thin client network. This is the computer system that really is the platform for all of our educational and law library software programs. Some of our community college partners have added additional donated computers with more updated programs to attempt to increase access to technology. Unfortunately, the thin client is the only computer system DOC provides for education outside of the GED testing computers. Currently, two of the software programs we use for education are actually unable to function on the thin client network due to its age. So if the thin client network went down, we would no longer have any computer-based learning tools, except some limited keyboarding programs and our GED testing computers. So some of the institutions would be able to use the computers donated by community colleges, but those machines do not have all the educational software, so it really isn't a great backup plan by any stretch of the imagination. With a one-time capital investment of approximately $600,000, we would be able to acquire current hardware that meets today's standards and can more effectively provide the required inmate services. So in order to achieve the almost $28 million of resources to fund the capital investments, it will require an appropriation from you of just over $4 million in general fund for debt service for 15-17. The cost of issuing the debt will require just over $500,000 of the generated bond proceeds, and the estimated debt schedule calls for an additional $30 million of general fund for future biennium debt cost. Now, the technical adjustments packages provided for categorical shifts in expenditure activity, as well as a federal fund limitation increase that enables us to more efficiently and effectively manage our resource and operations. The total cost of the technical adjustment for categorical shifts nets to zero, and the increase in federal funds limitation is about $123,000. To wrap up the 15-17 governor's budget, this chart recaps the essential packages, policy option packages, and recommended reductions. The governor's budget includes $25 million in general fund budget reductions. This included a $15 million reduction to the Community Corrections Grant in Aid Program and $10 million in the vacancy factor, increased in the vacancy factor. The Community Corrections reduction would reduce the Grant in Aid formula below its statutory defined formula, triggering an opt-out, giving the counties an option to transfer their supervisory responsibilities back to the state, just like occurred in Douglas and Linn counties years ago. If counties choose to opt out, the Department of Corrections would be responsible for supervising those counties. Now, I understand that money was actually put back into the co-chair's budget, but I do want to remind the committee that this, as is written in the governor's balance, in the governor's budget, would trigger that opt-out. There was also an increase of $10 million in the agency vacancy factor, which would require the department to identify ways to achieve savings by holding positions vacant in order to get to that $10 million. The last time we met, the April prison population forecast had yet to been released. It was released on April 1st after our Phase 1 presentation. Based on this forecast, the total inmate population will grow from 14,584 inmates on March 1 to an estimated 15,046 inmates on March 1st, 2025. So this actually represents a 3.2% growth in the inmate population over the next 10 years. This means that we will continue to use 964 emergency beds, and we anticipate we can continue to house the forecasted population within our existing activated facilities until March 1st, 2019. In terms of the male population alone, and we'll talk about the women here in a minute, we estimate that on July 1, 2019, that's when we'll need to begin activating the Deer Ridge Correctional Institution in Madras. Again, that's the medium facility. In our current plan, all our temporary and emergency beds will be offline in the 10-year period. We are grateful for that, although I will tell you that our staff breathe a sigh of nervousness that it will take us 10 years to phase those out, but the current plan does phase those out over 10 years. Junction City, as you can see by this chart here, actually is pushed out beyond our 10-year projection period. Now, our female population. Based on the current forecast, we would actually need to activate the Oregon State Penitentiary minimum to effectively house the forecasted female population going forward and return Coffee Creek Correctional Facility back to its original design. The female population today is at 1,275, so it's dangerously close to the 1,280 number which we've delineated that requires us to activate OSPM. So, quite frankly, if we didn't see the drop down, the dip in the female population based on the forecast, we would be talking about opening OSPM today because we are 5 beds away from that area or from that line that we have delineated.
Just a moment, Director. Representative Williamson.
Colette, why the drop?
Excuse me. Co-chairs, I thought you'd ask a longer question. I
guess sorry. what assumptions are in that forecast that makes it drop?
So those are the assumptions created by the Criminal Justice Commission, and I wouldn't be able to talk effectively about the cause and the drop, but we certainly can get that information and get it to the committee as to what is actually driving that drop. But it is projected, and it does give us a sense of relief knowing that it's going to drop down a little bit before it comes back again around 2019, the beginning of 2019, where then we'd need to talk about activating OSPM.
Senator Winters.
Yes, I think it's critical that we get the assumptions from the Criminal Justice Commission for planning purposes. 2019 is not that far out.
Let's see if we get that in writing from them.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, we will certainly get that to you in writing.
Senator Bates.
Mr. Co-chair and director, these numbers are so small that statistically they're meaningless. You could easily have a bump of 5, 10, or 15. And I don't know what they use to back these numbers up, but the fact is it's a flip of a coin. If these were, you know, 500, 400, 300, I'd feel comfortable. You're at the edge right now, really. There's a few more coming in for whatever reason, and you're over the top. So I'm not sure that planning on staying where we're at this point is the wisest choice. You could have this change by September of this year and be in trouble. Is that built into the budget?
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, I really appreciate that point. We've been on the cutting edge, on the edge for both our male population and our female population for quite some time. I will tell you that there was even a time a year ago where we thought we were going to have to activate Deer Ridge Correctional Institution. I will tell you that thanks to the good work of our staff, the Department of Corrections really is committed to the justice reinvestment conversation. And so we're really trying to do our part to manage this population the best that we can. We are actually requesting today that you consider adopting a budget note that would enable the department to report back during the interim on the status of the female population if we do see a dip. I appreciate you saying we could be up there by September. We could be up there by the end of the week. The number is so small. And so we are also recommending that you consider creating some form of funding contingency should it become necessary to activate OSPM in the biennium. In addition, I wanted to speak to Representative Williamson's bill, House Bill 3503, which would divert primary parents in certain situations from coming to prison entirely, which we hope will further mitigate this issue and are creeping up against that line.
You read our minds.
Yeah.
Senator Bates.
And just for follow, I'm going to ask us to consider putting together a spot for this. I just think this is just too a tricky situation. We're going to be leaving sometime, hopefully in late June, early July, and this could blow up at any moment, and then we need to have some way of handling this in the interim through ways and means, but be ready to do it. I just think we're too close. I just don't see how you can't predict something this close.
Senator Winters.
Mr. Chair, I think that this is something not only with special purpose, but that with House Bill 3503, and that's something that we actually monitor and come back even during the interim when we're here, so that we're talking about, you know, what impact 3503 have, what's going on in the spike. And then there's another component of this. I think it gives us a chance to have conversation with CJC and our partners who actually help to increase your population.
Look at that. Please continue.
Thank you, co-chairs, and thank you, Senator Winters. And I think you're absolutely right, and I've talked to you about this individually and at the committee level. That conversation with our partners is so important, and I think a lot of that collaboration was born out of 3194. I will tell you, I'm incredibly proud of a handful of counties that raised their hand and volunteered to be a pilot for Representative Williamson's bill. I think that sort of collaboration and partnership really came out of public safety reform, and it's something I'm very proud of. So those conversations will continue, there's no doubt.
Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm right along with the director on how proud I am of the public safety community coming together, because that was not the case really before the Public Safety Commission. And in the counties raising their hand saying, we want to participate in 3503, some of them had never looked at their female population in any sort of real way. So they had no idea why they were sending so many women to prison or that the change was as dramatic as it had been. And so in addition to the larger 3194 conversation, I think we're using data a lot better as a community around our populations and what goes into the forecast and all of that. And so I know the CJC will be coming in on 3503. They're running numbers right now. And counties are putting together what their program would look like. So we should have that soon.
And we're hopeful to move that out of Ways and Means soon as well, because I think it's pretty clear we're desperately going to need that. All right.
Well, can I want to, yes. This forecast as well is emergency beds. I mean, when we hit OSP minimum, that's we're maxed out on emergency beds. So we're actually over capacity now. Within five women of opening OSPM, but we're already over capacity.
Co-chair, specifically Representative Williamson, that's absolutely correct. Thank you for acknowledging that. And the justice reinvestment.
And just what I was thinking as far as timing is concerned, at around 2:05, we'll let Ken Allen come in and make his comments. And then depending on how long that takes, get you back up here.
Great. Thank you, Senator. I will keep track of the clock. So the justice reinvestment conversation is a great segue into this next slide. The April 2015 forecast has the inmate population growing 141 inmates more in 15-17 compared to the October 2014 forecast. This comes at a cost of an additional $3 million more than what was represented in the governor's budget. The average caseload for community corrections increases by 485 individuals compared to the October 2014 forecast, costing just over almost $4 million, $3.7 million than what was represented in the governor's balanced budget. I bring that to you to have a quick conversation around cost avoidance. We talked about it in much detail during phase one, but the estimated 15-17 10-year cost avoidance based on the most recent population forecast is now $52.7 million. So that's reflected of a cost avoidance at the Department of Corrections in $61.9 million, offset by the cost to community corrections of $9.2 million. Now, this is a drum I will continue to beat as long as you will let me beat it. Staff wellness. During phase one, you learned that we have made staff wellness our agency top initiative. After two studies confirmed that what we suspected, our staff are not well with both mental health issues and physical issues. I bring this up again because while it was not a policy option package included in the governor's budget, the co-chairs and members of this committee expressed interest in considering our staff wellness package. So I wanted to bring it again before you today. So the data points are startling. One in three of our Department of Corrections employees have symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. That ratio is higher than police officers, firefighters, even those in active military duty. And research shows that employees exhibiting symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder have higher levels of tobacco use, alcohol use, which means more health problems, a higher number of workday absences, higher number of doctor visits. And two recent research studies, one conducted by PSU, one conducted by OSHU, found our staff have incredibly high levels of cholesterol, high triglycerides, high blood pressure, high BMI, high levels of perceived danger and hypervigilance, and that does not leave when they leave the gate. A presence of depressive symptoms, high levels of work-family conflict, and they average less than 6 hours of sleep per night. And I think I shared with you, I used to average less than 6 hours of sleep per night until this study let me know that that is equal to smoking a pack of cigarettes. So we need to do something about this. So this wellness package we proposed actually creates a wellness coordinator position that can actually help manage this very important, vital, strategic initiative. Right now, we have people on the ground doing great work, and it's really a grassroots project in our institutions and at our work sites. But we need someone to really manage this, rely on researchers to come in and help us create a consistent program. Another issue, and I think I shared the story with you last time, that the overtime factor for our staff is very substantial. I remember talking to an officer at Coffee Creek who was already and engaged around staff wellness and was actually thanking me for making it the agency's staff number one priority. And while he was giving us accolades for taking this on and told me that he really believed that I believed in staff wellness, he said his wife didn't believe me. And she didn't believe me because he has to work mandatory overtime again and again, which wreaks havoc on his own physical well-being and the well-being of his family. And so we had ASCA, the Association of State Correctional Administrators, come in and look at two data points in our system. Our relief factor had not been reviewed since the mid to late 90s, and that was before OFLA, before FEMLA, before all of the military leave that the Department of Corrections has engaged in. And during ASCA's evaluation, they determined what relief factor was needed to more effectively control that overtime. In their evaluation, ASCA determined DOC's post-relief factor at the time to be 1.7 for a 7-day post and 1.2 for a 5-day post. Their recommendation, based on best practices, was that we operate our relief factor at 1.72 for a 7-day post and 1.23 for a 5-day post, which equated to approximately 33 additional positions across the department at a cost of approximately $5.6 million. They also noted the gap for staffing, where there are certain posts that are not in line with best correctional practices, and recommended the creation of additional posts to meet best correctional practices, which equated to an additional 67 positions and $11.4 million. So while the majority of our policy action package is actually additional on the ground posts in our institution, it also included that wellness coordinator to help organize all of these efforts.
Mr. Chair?
Yep. Representative Krieger.
Who did the study?
Co-chairs and Representative Krieger, the health studies were done by PSU and OHSU. PSU actually looked at the mental health well-being of our staff. OHSU actually looked at the physical well-being of our staff. The analysis around our relief factor and our staffing patterns was actually done by the Association of State Correctional Administrators, which is a national association of my peers across the country.
Follow up. I wonder what happened. You did the same study on legislators.
Because oh, dear.
I was in the building 60 hours last week. I don't get 6 hours sleep.
That's the problem.
Yeah. That's why I'm cranky. I bet you that we wouldn't be very healthy either. I bet the doctor could tell us that probably we're disproportionately in the wintertime when we're here with flu and other type symptoms because we start our systems of health start going down. I realize this is kind of off to the side, but a couple of weeks ago, I never saw a bunch of legislators or lobbyists that looked sicker in all my life.
It's the building.
Sure they did not look good.
Would you like to comment on that?
Co-chairs and Representative Krieger, I will leave that to the good doctor. Thank you.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Last week, I was at Columbia River with some corrections students, and we were talking to the staff there, and I don't remember the name, but one of the lieutenants. And I asked them, you know, of anything we could give you, if any equipment or anything else that we could get you, what would you ask for? And the lieutenant didn't, more staff. And it was, and this is a minimum. I mean, it's a step-down facility, but it's still a minimum. We went out to the yard where there were about 175 inmates. And about 50 had just left the yard. So because it was like 201, they actually had three whole corrections officers out there. But we're very lucky that inmates comply as well as they do, because we have a similar situation, by the way, at Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, same sort of thing. And I believe it was like one correction staff to a dormitory of like 60. And so when we talk about staff, definitely a serious need for that.
Co-chairs and Representative Gorsuch, thank you so much tonight. We really appreciate you taking the time to come into our institutions. You're absolutely correct. And in fact, when you think of the fact that we have 4,500 employees and we're really asking for an additional 33 positions for the relief factor and another 67 positions to fill the gap, it really is a drop in the bucket by comparison. If any of you, many of you have been to the Oregon State Penitentiary, and you'll know that we have cell blocks with over 400, almost 500 adults in custody, and often you'll have one or two officers on that unit. So that is no doubt the case. Thank you.
Madam Chair, speaking of OSP and the life or lack thereof life, has an analysis been done of how long we're going to be able to retain that facility?
Co-chair,
that's question number one. Mm-hmm. And question number two, I know that there's someone who shares my desire and hope that our one remaining facility that's all on one floor will one day become a facility for our aging out and population. So anyway.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, while we haven't done an official review of how long that facility could or should last, that is something that we could engage in. I will tell you that because of our amazing facility staff and their work, we have held that together. I will tell you, even our locking system is so antiquated in that prison. I believe there's only one person in Oregon that can help and come in when something is not working properly.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you could share with me at a later time what the 100 employees will actually do. You mentioned some numbers that were thought to be reasonable numbers, amount of overtime for 5-day and 7-day shifts, mm-hmm. I assume you're talking about.
Correct.
And how much that would bring that overtime down. I would guess that considering the stress level of being in this facility and watching that many inmates, any type of overtime is pretty rough. And I would also guess some of this may be driven by people just not wanting to come to work, and whoever's there has to stay then and cover for the person who doesn't come in. I would also guess that is more likely to occur evenings and weekends. I don't know for sure, but I would guess that's what's happening. And I'd like to look at those numbers and do this look at the study to make sure that you're really getting where you want to get. So like an awful small number, 100 people to fix this problem. Does it really fix the problem or just another Band-Aid over it?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Bates, we'd be happy to provide that information to you in writing. I think that it's certainly a step in the right direction, and given the budget reductions that we've had over the last 6, 7, 8 years, it would be welcomed relief to our staff. I can only imagine, Representative Gorsuch, if the lieutenant that you were talking to at Cumbria River didn't mention it, if I asked him, he would tell me they're even short lieutenants. And I have had, you know that it's a problem when you have frontline staff telling the director that we need additional management. And in fact, that's what they tell you, because we eliminated the seventh lieutenant position at all of our minimums during the budget reductions. And so now we actually have superintendents stepping in behind lieutenants when we don't have a lieutenant to run the facility. So thank you. So recognizing the time, we have one slide left. So if I can push through this slide, Mr. Allen says he has a little bit of wiggle room post 205. So I will do that if, Madam Chair, you agree.
I do.
Thank you. I do want to spend just a minute talking about the future, though, because while we've been talking about the budget and difficult staffing patterns, I think the future vision for the Department of Corrections is actually a really exciting one. We'll be engaging in many initiatives during the next biennium. We continue to implement our performance-based management system, which you'll remember we're calling CORE, Correctional Outcomes Through Research and Engagement. And again, we really are hoping that that brings more transparency to the agency, more confidence from you and other members of the public around how we're spending each and every dollar at the agency. And just as importantly, internal to our agency, we hope it continues to breathe empowerment and engagement in our frontline staff who are really doing the core of our work. We've developed breakthrough initiatives for the next 3 years. Again, our top initiative is and will continue to be staff wellness. Another initiative that we're really excited about is optimizing the use of special housing beds. Our principal focus will really be on the long-term effectiveness of placement in special housing as an inmate management tool. And I will tell you, this is a very complex and difficult conversation, one that we're having nationally. And so we're really proud that we were one of 5 states to be selected to participate in the Safe Alternatives to Segregation Project with the Vera Institute and the Department of Justice. So we will actually receive up to 2 years of technical assistance, which will really focus on analyzing the use of segregated housing and developmenting recommendations for its safe reduction, if that's deemed warranted, as well as initial assistance with implementing the recommendations that come out of the analysis. Another big issue for us, we know that 35% of our current workforce is eligible to retire today. In the next 5 years, that number grows to 53%. As it relates to management, I've asked for those numbers, but I can only imagine that that percentage even grows. So this is why workforce planning is one of our breakthrough initiatives. We've charged Assistant Director Chris Popoff with really figuring out a comprehensive plan for recruitment, succession planning, training, and bringing people again into retirement. So know that we will keep you abreast of those developments, but we hope to come up with a great plan to really be prepared for that next growth of the Department of Corrections. Sustainability. It has been and will continue to be one of our top focuses. We are an incredibly large organization. We have 14 prisons, or 14 cities, if you will, scattered across the state. So we have the ability to positively impact the carbon footprint in Oregon, one way or the other. So we take that responsibility very seriously. The CDC, just as one example of the things that we, the items that we've accomplished with sustainability. Our statewide recycling center has presented these data points. We have been able to recycle almost 500,000 pounds of paper, 70,000 pounds of confidential shredded paper, 463,000 of plastic, 463,000 pounds of e-waste. So recycling is one way in which we're reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and the overall carbon footprint of the department. So just to give you a couple of analogies, we've saved almost 5,000 trees. We've reduced greenhouse gas emission equivalent to removing 457 cars from the road for a year. Pretty substantial. We've reduced water consumption, which would be the equivalent of 70,000 baths in a year. We've saved energy equivalent of 65,000 gallons of gasoline and eliminated the cost of hauling 8,373 cubic yards of waste to a landfill. So those are efforts that we're able to really turn that dial pretty substantially given the mass of our operations. So while we have so much to accomplish and so many challenges ahead, it really is an exciting time to be in corrections, and we're looking forward to the next biennium. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. One last thing for my visit last week. It was a very insightful experience talking to the staff there, and I have to tell you, I was very impressed. All of the staff that we talked to were very engaged and willing to share what they were doing with my students, which was really helpful. But the amount of rehabilitative work that was going on there, and the drug and alcohol counseling, and they need to keep the dog, by the way. The dog is really cool.
They have a dog in the alcohol and drug treatment that's, a retired drug dog, and that dog seems to be extremely popular. I understand there's a training program for special dogs at Coffee Creek. What do they call those? Not rescue dogs.
The service dogs.
Yeah. So it was a good experience, but it is disturbing that the one person who had been their only escape in quite a long time only made it as far as the Taco Bell before he was picked up again, which is not so good.
Madam Co-Chair.
Not good escape skills. That's all I can say.
And Representative Gorsuch, I thank you for those comments. Your observations around my staff do not come as a surprise. We have amazing people inside this organization. I could not be more proud. We are grateful that when the adults in our custody made bad choices, we are able to capture them quickly. I will let you know that that individual was actually found by one of our transport officers,
who
was picking up a burger that day. Our last escapees in Coos Bay actually escaped on the day that we had thousands of law enforcement officers in town grieving the loss of one of our officers. But again, not a great day to escape. So with that, thank you, committee.
It doesn't say much, the fact that he goes to Taco Bell about your food.
He made a run for the border.
Well, he did.
First place.
But the other thing that was really impressive is the reintegration program that they told us about, where they actually take folks out on field trips because it's a step-down facility and they're getting ready to be released. And they actually go out and try to, you know, let them know what's the world like after you've been gone for 10 or 15, 20 years. And I thought that was an invaluable piece of that project. Very, very good.
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Gorsuch, it's a key program. It truly is. Some of these individuals have no idea how to use a bank kiosk, as an example. So while it's very staff intensive, it makes for a much smoother transition. Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, but we need to get Ken Allen up
here. Yes.
So.
We didn't delve into the whole issue of geriatrics. So at some point in the future, since some of us are chronologically advantaged and recognize that populations are getting older and more infirmed and what have you, I still, whether we do it, we probably won't do it this biennium, but we still need to begin to look at those trends and look at how we address those particular issues. And I would really like to get that accomplished before one of my trusted individuals who've been around here probably as long or longer than I have, who understands this issue. So thank you very much.
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Winters, we're happy to have that conversation. That population is my fastest growing population at the Department of Corrections. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Peters. With that, I'm going to call up Ken Allen. We ate up 5 minutes of your time, Ken. Sorry. Sorry about that.
Geriatrics.
We're a very curious bunch.
Still dangerous.
Co-Chair, I'm very used to sharing time with the department director. And I'm Ken Allen. I'm the director of AFSCME Council 75. This is Tim Woolery, our staff, who has the primary responsibility for our corrections employees. He coordinates them. We represent over 3,000 corrections employees in most of the facilities throughout Oregon. And so I couldn't think of in my 25 years of working around the Department of Corrections and with directors, there's nobody I'd rather work with on these problems than this director. She knows how to say no, but she knows how to work with us and get to a resolution of problems, and we really appreciate her. I think the package that addresses wellness and stress, the extra positions that you referenced, Senator Bates, I've been out at 7 facilities in the last 2 months, and I've seen probably 850 out of the 900 and some emergency beds. And a lot of them are in the minimum facilities. There are an extra row of bunks that reduce the visibility to the back row of bunks. And the kind of stress that places on the officers for their shift is palpable. You know, it's every one of those officers where there's been extra bunks that has brought it up to me. I've seen a cell at EOCI. To say that you would think it would be okay for two people to live in it is one thing, but to say that four people are in it almost stacked like cordwood is a tough situation for the corrections officers too, because they know that the kind of stress that that raises. I want to specifically talk about our HB 2805 about including county comparators into the mix around collective bargaining. And I've been bargaining for, I'm in my 41st year, and off and on, mostly on with the state of Oregon since 1977. I bargain our AFSCME central table, 20-some agencies, and so I have a little bit of experience with this, and I've done interest arbs before too. The fiscal that's been assigned to this is frankly a sky is falling fiscal. There's no way to determine what the fiscal should be assigned to, including the county comparators. The comparators were changed for the state police in 2009, and we modeled this bill after that change. And the state police have not been to binding arbitration since 2009 when the statutes changed. And their settlement 2 years ago looked pretty much exactly like the rest of state employees' settlement. So, we shouldn't go to the extreme. I have never seen a reluctance on the state of Oregon's negotiators to say no if they think that we've asked for too much money. And I don't think that they would jump up to give us wage increases equal to the county employers, in the first round of bargaining. That just doesn't happen, and that's what this fiscal is based on. I don't think we should ever be penny wise and pound foolish, and one of the examples that the director talked about was the future staffing needs of the department and the number of retirements. There's really two elements about state corrections officers' pay lagging local governments. There's the issue that you lose state corrections officers after they've been trained to those county governments, but there's also a bigger kind of unmeasured issue. How many of the best and brightest folks, the most qualified to start out a corrections career, aren't even applying with the state of Oregon because they know they can make more money in Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Lane, Marion County, and others? They just don't apply to go to work for state of Oregon, and so we're missing out on them. So it's really important for us to really look at the comparators that matter. We don't lose corrections officers to other states. We lose corrections officers to our local governments. So if anybody has any questions about that, I'd be happy to.
I Representative Barker.
So it seems like a session or two ago, we passed a bill for the Oregon State Police that said their comparators would be the counties, and you're not covered under that?
No, we're not covered under that, Co-Chair and Representative Barker. Exactly right. We're not covered under that. It was just for police, and since that happened, they have not been to binding arbitration.
And Ken, I apologize. I had to step out. I had a workers' comp board issue that I had to discuss out in the hall about a potential move. Good. So where are we in your presentation?
We're just talking about the comparators bill, House Bill 2805, and the fiscal that's been attached to that. I don't think it's realistic based on all my years of bargaining and knowing that the employer can still say no. I know that Tim can speak to the issues about the extra staff that are proposed for the facilities, if you have questions about that too. Or.
Kind of paint a picture from the workers' point of view about the wellness issue and how you see that.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shields and members of the committee. I was a correctional officer for 18 years before I came over to do the job with the AFSCME for the last 10 years of being their lead negotiator for corrections. And I have a in-depth knowledge of the fact that we simply don't have enough staff. Just like Representative Gortz said and Senator Bates, the actual relief factor needed for the Department of Corrections to operate and what that speaks to is how often you can be away from your job, because every time a person has to go to training, vacation, they're sick, FMLA, any of these things, another person has to take their place. And if you don't have another person, then you have to mandatorily or occasionally voluntarily assign overtime for that. So the relief factor that would take care of the situation completely is in the neighborhood of 2%, which is far cry above the 1.72 that the ACA has suggested. I know that's unrealistic. That's in the neighborhood of 400 or 500 positions, but this is a step in the right direction.
Senator Bark, I mean Representative Bark.
Comment something that hasn't been talked about. By requiring the mandatory overtime, you're raising people's salaries, which will affect the retirements. Depending on you, if it's my retirement, it'd be a positive way, but overall, in a negative way, because people are final average salaries are going to be going up because they're required to stick it out, and while and all the problems with that not being good for their health and just the stress and the retirement, that's not a job for somebody who's worn out. I would not think. I've never done that job, but it just led people in corrections.
Co-Chair Shields and Representative Barker, I completely agree with you. Not only that, if you're there for 16 hours, towards the end of that 16 hours, plus if you've done it more than once that week, you're not as aware of what's going on as what you should be, and therefore you're somewhat of a liability for the other employees as well as yourself and the inmates. So it's a compounding factor.
Well, and I told the director that we're looking very seriously at that policy option package and want to see if we can provide some relief. Not sure we'll be able to get to 100 positions, but we hope to step in that direction.
Well, Senator Shields and the committee, I want to assure you that this union will work hard on trying to improve the health and safety of our members. We take it very seriously, and it doesn't feel good to us that they have these health problems. I'm on the OHSU Board of Directors, and the doctors that did that study are nationally known for having studied issues for public safety employees. These are experts about public safety employees and health risks.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Good. Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. And we'll dive back into the DOC, or you're done for the day. Oh, all right.
We're
getting out 10 minutes early.
How about that?
Okay. And you want to tee anything up for us for tomorrow?
There will be no meeting tomorrow as a result of corrections finishing today. So,
bonus.
Possible right. Meeting on Thursday. I think you're aware of that one.
Okay. Good. We are adjourned.
Thursday meeting.
Good. We are adjourned.